You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines around our area this past week. Our guest today, Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on Your Side Television, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, and Bill Manny, also with Idaho Public Television. Welcome, everyone.
Hi, Gemma. Hi there, Gemma.
And a quick note, we are gearing up for election coverage in advance of the December 3rd runoff in Boise and Caldwell. As you know, we've talked with political scientists, we've talked with reporters covering this story. Well, we want to hear from you as well. If you have a question about how the runoffs will work, maybe you have a comment about the elections, we actually want to know. So submit a question or a comment on our website, search Idaho Matters in your web browser, or you can search the Idaho Matters hashtag on Twitter. And speaking of elections, since we're still in the midst of election season, who knew? But we are. Let's talk a little bit about where we're at with the election. Even though the runoff is not until December 3rd in both Boise and in Caldwell, early voting has already started.
And, absolutely.
And have we heard anything about how that's going?
Well, in addition to the, I thought, really interesting report that you guys had on George Prince's show this morning, just with a cross-section of voters talking about why they were voting early, there is a wealth of information on the Ada County elections website, and he tracks that stuff in real time, Phil McGrain does. And so I went on there this morning, and 4,032 people have voted already early in the Boise mayoral election, which is compared to 5,600 people who voted in November. So you already have 4,000 people voting early in this election. So I think, you know, it used to be, the theory used to be people who vote early were just people who weren't going to vote later. But now I think the measure is people who vote early are an indication that there's high interest in an election. And so I think what we're seeing is an early indication that this remains high, even though it's this strange timing, right? Mm-hmm. The Tuesday right after Thanksgiving Day weekend.
Melissa, before we came on the air, we were talking about kind of a what we'd call maybe a Twitter rampage that that happened. Maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but
no, not at all. I love that phrase.
But because this goes into what is going on with this election in the Boise mayoral race, and frankly the tension and really kind of going down a negative path that we're starting to see.
Absolutely. And this is something that has been building for a long time on both sides, as far as that tension and frustration. So I would say that something I've noticed is a lot of McClain supporters have really been paying attention to beater supporters and the language they use to describe a relatively young woman running for mayor. Earlier this week, Councilman Scott Ludwig said it wasn't Lauren McClain's turn to be mayor, that he, you know, appreciated and respected her as a colleague, considered her a friend, but it wasn't her time yet. And a lot of people took exception to that, especially women who have heard repeatedly that, you know, we just need to wait our turns. And so,
because we've never heard that our entire lives.
And this is something that Beter said in one of his forums back before the general election in October. And so he apologized, but he sent the apology through Lauren McClain, which I found interesting. He put, once again, the responsibility on Lauren to disseminate his apology, which I thought was pretty remarkable. And then on Thursday night, Councilman T.J. Thompson got frustrated at one of the reporters who was covering the race, Margaret Carmel from the Idaho Press, and said, why isn't anyone covering the fact that none of Lauren McClain's colleagues, past or present, have endorsed her? Nobody wants her to be mayor if they've worked with her. And that, you know, is a legitimate point. That's something that came up during the Paulette Jordan campaign, that none of her legislative colleagues had endorsed her in the primary. But one thing that stood out to the people who saw this comment that was made in a public forum on Twitter was that it was directed at a young woman who was covering the election, as opposed to any one of the, you know, number of other reporters who have been covering this race.
Who could be doing that very story that he's suggesting should be written?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The fact that he was publicly going after a young female reporter as opposed to, say, Mike Sharp from KIVI or Jimmy Dawson from KBSX.
And I want to jump in here really quickly about Margaret Carmel, because she has been on this program. She was on the Reporter Roundtable, in fact, last Friday. She is an outstanding journalist. So for someone to go after her, I mean, is frankly not okay, because of the fact that she does her job. She researches, she reports, she goes to the Boise City Council meeting every single week. And we need to point out that she is an incredible journalist.
And, you know, none of us are immune from questions of our coverage. None of us are immune from criticism. And it was a legitimate question that TJ Thompson had. Absolutely. Why is nobody focusing on this? So that in and of itself isn't uncommon. But some people who were watching this unfold live on Twitter, this discussion happened in real time, we're saying, oh, wait a minute, like, why didn't you go after Don Day for this exact same thing? It kind of escalated from there, and a number of people pointed out that the only people he was kind of attacking at the time, again, were young women. A lot of McLean supporters were jumping into either Margaret's defense or Lauren McLean's defense, that sort of thing. By this morning, he had deleted his account and he hasn't said anything since. And so I think that it is another indicator of how tense this race is becoming and, frankly, of how tired some Lauren McLean supporters are of the sexism that they believe they're seeing on the campaign. Now, whether or not it's intentional, that's not up for me to say, but I'm really noticing a lot of women are taking exception to the way that some beater supporters are talking about Lauren as a candidate.
You know, what strikes me as odd about this whole conversation is how tone deaf that sounds given. I mean, think about the results in early November. 2 out of 3 voters voted for the woman in that race. Now, whether they're going to continue that support, she still beat beater 3-2. And so it's not like the voters haven't already indicated that they are willing to support someone like this. And so it just strikes me as that's a tone-deaf conversation to be having. There's all kinds of things we can be talking about this race. Now going back and kind of suggesting that somehow she's not a legitimate candidate just seems like a very strange point for us to be at in this race. The other thing I was going to note about this is that the data about the way people vote in these elections, usually people, absentee and early voting, people tend to wait. It really spikes at the end of that process, right? Because people wait to see if there's new information or something. That's not happening. The people are voting now. They're not waiting till the end of this election. You don't see that spike at the end. Right now we're seeing the spike early on in early voting. And so I think that's another indication people have made up their minds.
I mean, and to be fair, as we've all said here, for TJ Thompson to bring up this, to point out that none of her colleagues have endorsed her is legitimate.
Completely legitimate.
Absolutely legitimate. People on city council also know how to contact journalists to point that out, to say, hey, this might be a good story to cover without having to go on to the attack.
And I don't even think he meant it as an attack. I thought that he, based on some of the things that I saw him say online, he thought he was opening up a line of communication with her. But it was the criticisms that were coming in after about like, hey, dude, with the optics on this, it doesn't look very good that you are going singularly after this one woman journalist. And so that shift in the discussion where it's not just about policy anymore, it's about how people are talking about women in politics is something I'm really seeing among supporters of McLean.
I want to switch gears because some big news came out of the governor's office this week regarding hemp being transported throughout the state of Idaho. And since we have Bill on the show, it seems that we cannot have you on without talking about hemp and marijuana.
Right. Well, the backstory is I grew up in Pendleton, Oregon, right? So every time I go back to visit my mom, people think that I have ulterior motives for visiting Oregon.
Does your mom still live in Pendleton? I mean, does she still live there?
She still lives there.
Who do you have to blame for this?
And I'm going back to see my mom next week for Thanksgiving. So I'm warning the state police right now. I'll be traveling across the borders and I will be perfectly legal both directions.
I'm only bringing a turkey. That's it.
Nonetheless, I I find this a fascinating issue for Idaho public policy. And, you know, once again, Idaho's kind of strange love-hate relation with marijuana. Well, it's a hate relationship. I guess there's no love there. We are an island of prohibition in this sea of permissive policies. And at least this week, it strikes me that we've applied a little bit of common sense to what is often hysterical approach to marijuana in Idaho. And Governor Little said that we're going to align ourselves with the Farm Bill and the federal rules, and people who are engaged in legal commercial activities are going to be able to come through Idaho and trust that they're not going to be stopped and arrested and had their products seized.
As a nerd, I just have to say, having covered the State House as long as I have, I just love that this issue is actually bringing up – it's like a civics class, because I feel like I've had the conversation with people inside the newsroom, people outside the newsroom, family, explaining, you know, how the Farm Bill passed and how administrative rules have to come after that and how the processes actually move pretty slow, and how you mentioned that he was trying to square up with the Farm Bill. Well, the Farm Bill was passed in 2018, right? So what's the delay here? And it takes time. It takes the verbiage that came through the USDA and the way that they were going to enforce this rule and who was actually going to be doing the testing and how they were going to validate this testing so that they felt comfortable with this coming through the state. So it's interesting to see this finally starting to affect Idaho.
Yes, and even though I think it's a good signal that we're applying some common sense and that Governor Little is kind of applying his moderate middle of the road approach, I don't think Melissa agrees with me.
Yeah, fellow nerd here. Idaho's hand was forced by the federal government, and that's something that Governor Little made very clear, I think, in the executive order and in the press release. Now, the legislature took a swing at this. It's one of the things, one of many things that fell apart toward the end of the disastrous 2018 session. But he had all summer to do this, right? And after a lot of controversy involving two truckers who were pulled over, and by the way, this does not apply retroactively
right,
to
them. Right, it doesn't at all.
That was made very clear in the executive order that this is, you know, from October 31st on, that this new rule is applying. Idaho's hand was forced on this by the federal government, by the Trump administration. And if you had that on your bingo card from 8 years ago, my hat's off to you.
Right, marijuana, and it's going to keep coming back. I mean, marijuana was mentioned by Governor Little, even in his letter about C. Scott Groh's bill to change the way the referendum process was going to happen, right? Marijuana is circled, and it's a big deal to this administration. So it's not like this is going to clear the way for massive change in laws in the next legislative session. I think there's going to be a fight about whatever this legislation is going to look like just to make it so that we at least let it continue in this state.
If you really read the executive order, it is probably one of the most restrictive ways to allow this transport to happen across the state as possible. It is very strict parameters. And again, I believe that the Little administration would not have considered this if it weren't for that Farm Bill.
Well, and to, you know, throw something else out there. I mean, one could argue that one of the reasons why many legislators wanted to change how a citizen initiative gets on the ballot last legislative session was to make sure that a ballot initiative regarding marijuana
right.
never sees the light of day.
Yeah, medical marijuana or some other permissive approach. But we're not talking about marijuana here.
We're talking about hemp.
Legal hemp. You know, we're talking about an agricultural commodity. You would think that the farmers and the ranchers who run the Idaho legislature and who sit in the governor's office, you know, would be cool with that. And so it's interesting to see them, as Melissa said, you know, kind of grudgingly go along with this. It is interesting to note that of all the candidates in the Republican primary last year, Governor Little was the most anti-marijuana and the most skeptical about hemp. So I suppose he's just being consistent, if nothing else.
Right. And Governor Little, he's not alone on this, but the legislature isn't necessarily behind him when it comes to the reluctance about hemp.
Well,
there are a lot of Republican state legislators, especially in the agriculture community, that are ready to make this be a commodity crop.
That bill from the last legislature was co-sponsored by Republicans. Mm-hmm. It was a Republican-sponsored bill.
Well, and could there also, if Governor Little had not made this executive order, I mean, this is a federal farm bill. So the nerds like you, Mike, could a lawsuit come about? I mean, could the state be? I mean, that,
there's already a law, right?
Like, so when I saw that, that was what I thought was, well, of course they're doing this. They don't want to get sued and go down that path. How many times?
Anytime the state has a law that is somehow more restrictive than the federal government's law, it's going to cause problems. And the Idaho State Police, they are there to enact Idaho's laws, and they're not necessarily operating under the federal laws. And so they're going to continue doing things, even though these people are acting within the federal government and the guidelines that they've been given, and they're doing things totally legally within the state of Idaho. They can still be busted.
That said, Idaho is not above taking on windmills against the federal government to make a point, even though they know they're going to lose in court, right? I mean, we have a fund kind of
name
that pays
times.
For that.
It's kind of Idaho's brand. It's Idaho's brand.
That's what we do.
God bless Idaho. Let's talk about what is going on at BYU-Idaho regarding Medicaid, Melissa. Our Jimmy Dawson has been covering this as well. But kind of if people haven't heard what's going on, get us up to date on this.
Yeah, Jimmy's been doing a great job. And there are a number of other reporters across the state and now across the country whose radar this is on. BYU-Idaho last week, there were a few students who were confused as to why their Medicaid had been rejected when they submitted it as their insurance. And then a couple days later, BYU-Idaho announced, to many people's surprise, that it would no longer be accepting Medicaid for student health insurance, and that students needed to find an alternative. Rexburg and the Jefferson County area are actually relatively low income compared to the rest of the state, and there are a lot of students, young families who are just starting out, who either currently qualify for Medicaid or will qualify for Medicaid under the expansion starting in January. So this was a huge shock to a number of students who were really relying on and didn't think that it would be an issue. Why would it be an issue? They've accepted Medicaid in the past. Every other university accepts Medicaid. So there are a number of issues going on, a number of new developments. This has caught the national news media's attention. There are going to be a number of stories coming out in outlets in the next few days. The Salt Lake Tribune had a story out today where they interviewed a number of students who were considering dropping out. It's not an insignificant number of students that this affects. There are a lot of people who are saying that I flat out cannot afford to continue my education anymore and either have to transfer or just drop out entirely. BYU-Idaho is not giving interviews. They're not really answering questions. On Wednesday, they kind of came out with this statement that they had talked to the local medical community, and they said that any number of, you know, if they accepted all of these new Medicaid patients who were students, then their offices would be overwhelmed. Well, that doesn't make sense. And also, Nikki Forbing Orr from the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare told the Salt Lake Tribune, in my words, not hers, that that's hot garbage nonsense. There are plenty of providers there.
Now, that would have been good if she'd said it just like that.
I know Nikki. She's not going to say that.
Nikki's a professional.
That's right.
Nikki's a professional. And she said there are a number of providers in the area, not just in Rexburg, but in the surrounding communities, who accept Medicaid patients. There's also the question as to why BYU-Idaho would be deferring to the doctors as opposed to trying to protect their students, who they should be advocating for in the first place. BYU-Idaho isn't answering questions. They are also there are reports coming out that they are preventing their student journalists from covering the issue. This is something that we at the Idaho Press Club are very concerned about, because not only does it stifle the conversation, it doesn't allow student reporters to do their jobs and bring this important information to light. It also means that the student body is getting less information. They rely on these student reporters to bring them the news. And who better to report this than the people who are on campus every single day? So, you know, we at the Press Club released a statement last night in support of these student journalists. If the university is okay with this decision,
why aren't they talking?
Why aren't they talking, and why are they stopping the student journalists from covering it? It just doesn't make sense.
There's a just there's a lot of things that don't make sense about this story, right? This policy doesn't align with the way BYU and Utah handles it. It doesn't align with the way other universities in Idaho handle it. So there's got to be a backstory here, right? There's got to be a reason why they're taking what looks like a political approach to a healthcare issue. And I think we're missing a big chunk of the story so far.
And there are so few things that are more important than a student's health when it comes to their entire well-being during their education career. This is something that really matters to everyone who attends that university, regardless of how you feel about Medicaid. Why isn't the university talking about it? Now, as to your point about there has to be a backstory. There are some hints. We don't have the full backstory because, again, nobody's talking. But if you look at the results from Jefferson County, where Rexburg is from the 2018 general election, Jefferson County was one of 10 counties that voted no on Proposition 2 to expand Medicaid, and did so by a pretty comfortable margin. This was a county that said, you know what, we are not okay with expanding Medicaid. They are also the county with the lowest voter turnout during the 2018 general election. And this is something that we covered at Idaho Reports, where they erroneously had signs up instructing students that they couldn't vote. If they hadn't voted absentee from their home counties, then they were not eligible to vote in Rexburg. This is something that they were reprimanded for by Secretary of State Lawrence Denny. And so there's this kind of theme going on where students are either not having their voices heard, or that what they're saying, which is, we want to use our Medicaid, this is going to ruin my life. The local officials aren't listening.
I can tell you, looking back at data, and you touched on this when you first started talking about the issue, no matter what data source you're looking at, if you look at census poverty data, if you look at food insecurity data from Feeding America, if you look at ALICE from United Way, every single time the counties, the surrounding areas around this university are some of the poorest and most in need. But they're also very reluctant to asking for help. It's a really fascinating area. They're very pick yourself up by your bootstraps. They're reluctant to brick and mortar pantries. They're reluctant to having mobile pantries, even from local food banks, come by and drop off food. Because a lot of times city leaders, community leaders, even university leaders have said in the past, like, we don't have a need here. It doesn't matter what the numbers say. So knowing that there is this huge need, and knowing that these students are the same people who are populating the school, obviously, it just makes it so much more almost egregious that these students don't have access to the very programs that are there to help them get through the school.
And if you read the interviews with students who are affected by this, but I mean, and there are some phenomenal journalists who are covering this, including, as you said, James Dawson, Nate Brown at the Post Register, and the Salt Lake Tribune. As I said, just this phenomenal story today where they talked about people who were in tears when they were talking about, look, I'm 4 credits away. I have a baby on the way, or I just recently had a baby, and I have to drop out of school. And again, if the university is comfortable with this decision, why isn't it talking about it?
Before we leave, Mike, you're about to release a documentary, KIVI is, about the 1999 Little League team.
Yes.
When I saw this, I was like, oh, that's right.
I'm very excited about this. I've been working on it since, I think, March. And I'm just done. Like, it's just been so much work. But it's like a 30-minute documentary. I've had so much fun researching it. Those of us at Six on Your Side, we organized a reunion of all of the players and coaches from the 1999 Little League World Series team. For those of you who don't remember or maybe weren't here at that time, it is still the only Treasure Valley team to move on to the Little League World Series. It happened 20 years ago. It was a short-staffed team, too. They were short, one player. And they just, you know, tore it up. They lost their first game of districts here and then won out through the consolation bracket, went to California. It was a much more difficult system back then to get through because you had to play everybody in the West in order to go, which means all of the California schools. So they went to San Bernardino, and then they went to Williamsport. And then looking back, you know, talking to these kids now, talking to the coaches now, one of them, Stephen Fife, went on to play 11 years in pro baseball, including with the Los Angeles Dodgers. One of the players, Seth Anderson, is now a coach at George Fox, his alma mater, coaching baseball. You've got Brian Champ, who played basketball and baseball at the College of Idaho, and now he's in the community. So many people are still in this community, and they're looking back. We actually brought them to a Little League game at the same field that, where they played all of their home games at Liberty Field. They were, back then it was the South Central Little League team. And so they got a chance to sign some autographs. And then the South Central Little League bought them each jerseys with the same colors that they wore when they played regionals here. So it was just a really cool experience.
I've got to say, this spring, I was Mike's assistant coach for a T-ball team. And he was telling me about this documentary he was working on, you know, back in March, because that's about when we started coaching together. And I have to say, I am so excited to see this because our little kids, you know, played on the South Boise Mets, mm-hmm. Go Mets, and they got to play in the same field as these guys that Mike's talking about. And it was really cool to learn about that history and see it all come together. And I'm so excited to learn more, Mike. It's going to be great.
So when will it air? When can people watch
it? Well, so we are going to air. We're kind of testing something new here. This is a really long form story that we're doing, and we're trying to do more of this, but it doesn't necessarily fit in traditional broadcast format. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a shortened, you know, 2 or 3 minute teaser. And then the documentary itself is going to lie for free online on our website, on our what we call OTT services. So if you have Amazon, if you're playing something through your Roku box, if you get our app, you'll be able to watch this full documentary. After the fact, we're going to talk a little bit more, hopefully bring them back and have bigger conversations. But we wanted to make sure this aired in 2019, so that we could hit that 20-year. I remember she mentioned, you know, coaching that team, and we were on that field, and I remember looking up. There's still a sign with all of their names on it, and you walk by it every single day, and that's kind of where the story started. Was I saw and I was like, man, it's been 20 years. I wonder where all those guys are, and to be able to pull them all back because they were all over the place, especially over the West. Well, to get them all back was really cool.
And I remember, I mean, as you know, I was here as a journalist 20 years ago. And, you know, everyone was watching them back in mm-hmm. Williams Park. I mean,
yeah,
it was
exciting. Their hair. They all had these bleached hair.
That's so 90s. I love
it.
So 90s.
It's when you watch the video, and they kept making reference. There's some things that we couldn't play just because of, you know, ability to get the rights. But they you know, they all remembered the same Smash Mouth song because they all were stuck on this van. And it was like the last era or the last year of this era where they weren't going to be on their phones.
Right.
Their parents didn't have cameras. If you look at the stands, nobody was shooting with cameras. They were all just watching the game. Everybody was actually present.
What a concept.
Yeah. It was a really cool, like, look back, and it seems like 1999 to me was, you know, last year. But looking back and seeing everything, it's remarkable.
Okay. Very, very quickly, because we cannot wrap this up without the fact that CWI has been looking for a new mascot. Sparkles the Unicorn did not make it into the finals.
I am devastated, Gemma.
I cannot believe
this. Is anybody happy with this?
No.
I don't know anybody who's happy with this.
Everyone wanted Sparkles.
I mean, that's
everyone.
Epic.
Everyone I know, and that's what matters.
I mean, you know, the Santa Cruz Banana Slugs, right? I mean, right. We know them because they have a unique name. Why not Sparkles the Unicorn?
Can you imagine the type of paraphernalia that would that students and alumni would be walking around
on? Oh, it wouldn't
community
just be
members.
Students and yeah, it would
right.
be nationwide. People
absolutely.
Would be watching or wearing CWI gear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Missed opportunity.
Total missed
Maybe
opportunity.
Maybe we can get Governor Little to issue an executive order.
Saying,
I think we're
going to
need another community
uniform.
College.
Yeah.
We're going to start the effort here.
Right now.
Has Eastern Idaho College picked a mascot yet? Let's get on
Let's
it.
Let's find out. I want to thank all of you for coming in today. Our reporter roundtable this Friday. Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side. Bill Manning with Idaho Public Television. And Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television. We'll be right back.